You're listening to The Daily Buzz on KCPW and kcpw.org. This is day six, and my name is John Wildman. I am the editor of Festworks.com, and we are on location in Park City, Utah at the 2017 Sundance Film Festival. We're coming to you from historic Main Street, where we will be for the next 4 days interviewing some of the most important voices in the independent film world. Our Daily Buzz studio is right in the center of all the festival action during the day at PC Live and is the home of Chef Dance at night. Joining me this morning are my co-host Irene Cho, also the producer of this program, and Minji Chang from Collaboration. Today we're going to be talking to Virginia Pierce about the Utah Film Commission and the work they're doing, as well as the filmmakers from the films Nobody Speak, Rancher Farmer Fisher, and 7852. And we're also going to be discussing the Synthesia suit and Infinite Res VR. We are back on The Daily Buzz. Again, my name is John Wildman from Festworks.com. On this segment, we're joined by our producer, Irene Cho. And we're going to talk about the Utah Film Commission with Virginia Pierce. Virginia, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
I am very excited to chat with you because I reside in Dallas and Texas. We are going through a lot of stuff with our film incentives, namely the legislature trying to cancel and remove all of the film incentives, and in fact even remove the Texas Film Commission. So it's great to talk to someone from another state and get your views on, one, what do you do in terms of incentives, in terms of rebates, things to encourage film production here in Utah?
So the Utah Film Commission has an incentive program, an ongoing incentive program that's been in place since 2011, and we receive almost $7 million a year for production incentives. It's an ongoing program, so we don't have to go up on the hill every year and fight for it. I know it's a tricky business for most states.
That must be a relief.
Yes.
Well, you know, I was really looking forward to talking to you because there is a simple math benefit to this, which is the incentives, the rebates that come with incentives really have a direct connection to creating jobs. And can you talk about that?
Yeah, so last year in Utah, we supported 27 projects that brought in almost $50 million in incentives, production spend. And it creates, 1,500 jobs. It really does support the local industry and create jobs and growth on the ground. So I do see the benefit. I think it's a great program. It's post-performance, so you get approved for an incentive, but you don't actually receive the money until after you've spent what you're going to spend in Utah. So,
can you talk a little bit about that process, Virginia? How do they submit an application? What kind of things are you looking for from filmmakers?
So we approve projects on a monthly basis, and you can submit your, application, your script. We sort of go through, what are you spending? How many days are you going to be on the ground? We look for economic impact. We look for Utah impact. So how many Utah people are you hiring? We do have a requirement that every production needs to hire at least 75% Utah cast and crew in order to qualify for the full 25%. There's other ways to get less than that. But really, it's what the incentive was created for, is to encourage, people to spend money and hire Utah people.
What does Utah offer that can attract filmmakers versus New Orleans or Atlanta or Vancouver?
So I think where we shine are our locations. We have, nature played favorites when it comes to Utah, and we definitely have locations you can't get anywhere else. We're also just a quick 90-minute flight from LA, so a lot of times people will say, well, we're looking at South Africa or Vancouver, and I'll help them compare costs to doing business in Utah, flying in their, VIPs from LA is much quicker and less expensive than it is to fly somewhere else. We also have been in the industry for a long time, and we've started film in Utah, started in the 1930s with the John Ford Westerns. We've really been going strong since then, so we have built up a reputation, an industry. We have a really professional workforce. People love working here. We actually have 4 films premiering at Sundance that were shot in Utah, and you listen to the directors and producers, they'd never shot in Utah before, And they really do, they're impressed with what they found. It's easy to do business here. The crews are friendly and professional. They know what they're doing. I think it's just a really different feel from some of the bigger industry hubs.
I remember years ago, one of my first jobs was as a production assistant for a couple Movie of the Weeks that shot in Utah.
That was big industry for us.
It was
back
a big
in the
industry.
Day.
Yes, it was. I would also like to talk. All right, people assume when they are not film savvy, film production savvy, they assume that benefits the people that that are hired for films, but it actually benefits entire communities. And and can you talk about that, those benefits? Give us a fuller picture for someone that maybe is not in the film industry as to who is getting these monies when a film comes to town.
So when you look at a year last year where we received an estimated $50 million of on-the-ground spending, almost 40% of that was in a rural area. So you get a film like Westworld that came in and shot their locations in Moab. They spent over $1 million in the city of Moab. They're booking hotel rooms. They're eating out. They're giving per diems to their cast and crew that then in turn go and spend those. They're hiring local caterers. They're using the dry cleaners. They're using the hardware store. That's really where you see the local and state spending happening, and it's sort of that ripple effect that you really do see.
Right. So it's not just for Evan Rachel Wood's hairdresser, and it's not just for Anthony Hopkins' driver. It literally does spread far and wide.
Well, and also let me remind your audience that our fund only pays back on what you spend in Utah to a Utah vendor. So we don't actually give money back on cast that come in from out of state. It's just it's the way that there are several incentives that do, several programs that do, but ours is really based on Utah spend.
All right.
And how do you get them to keep coming back? Do you have to outdo yourself every year, up the ante? Like, what are some of the incentives?
It really, Utah sells itself. Once people get here, and I think, you hear the same thing from people who moved here for a year, and all of a sudden it's 20 years later and they're still here. That is the same with film. Our biggest marketing source are our repeat filmmakers. So they come in once. They love the experience. Everyone is, I don't think we're a small enough program that we haven't gotten jaded about the film industry. People are still excited to see films shooting in their neighborhood. They still, they love Sundance. It's the whole culture of film in Utah really is one that we're proud of. So I think that's what tells the story.
Can I ask if there's been an increase in production crews out here? Like, is there more people getting jobs? I know they just opened the Park City Film Studios not too long ago. Was that kind of a result, do you think, of more people shooting here?
I think it contributed to that. We got ABC here because of the studio. We had Blood and Oil shooting here in 2015. As far as the size of the crew, it does increase. We have had a very busy couple of years. It's sort of an ebb and flow process. Right now, we are definitely on the high end, and I hope that continues. Right now, it's pretty based on incentives,
Tell us about your presence here on Main Street. I know the Utah Film Commission took over the Terzian Gallery. Mm-hmm. What sort of things do you have lined up, and what kind of things can our listeners participate in?
We are open to the public every day. We're open at 625 Main Street, and every morning at 10 o'clock we have what we're calling Coffee with the Commish. It's different topic every day. This morning we're doing one on casting. Tomorrow's on equipment that you might need to, how do you find the perfect equipment? Tuesday we're doing a documentary resources. Wednesday is all on digital. So different focus on the different sides of the industry in Utah.
Do you need a credential to get into that?
You don't. We are welcoming everyone.
That's great for our listeners, especially college students at the U and Westminster. If they're interested in learning more about how they can get involved on the film production side, they can come up to Main Street.
Yep. We got locally brewed Hugo coffee and good snacks from local vendors, so you should stop in.
I just want to add one thing. In addition to what you're doing at the Utah Film Commission, you have a very rich history of your experience at the Sundance Institute. So if you can touch a little bit about how that job prepared you for this current one.
So I was at Sundance for almost 14 years and kind of grew up there as far as my professional career goes. And I think part of what has made us successful in the last few years is I really knew the indie market. And that is I think, a great niche for Utah. And I obviously reached out to all of my friends and industry associates that I knew from Sundance and said, hey, you know, Utah is a great place to shoot. And I think that's paid off.
Well, you know, we have time for one more question, I believe. And of course, you said a couple times, which you're absolutely right, Utah certainly sells itself when it comes to locations and what have you. But another aspect that is always key for filming is the infrastructure. And can you talk about what Utah has to offer in terms of infrastructure that's on the ground that people don't have to bring into the state?
So because we've been in the industry for a long time, we do have, you know, we've got some great equipment houses. We have Park City Film Studios we talked about. We have as well in Salt Lake, there's a number of warehouses that have become essentially studios that have been doing it for a long, long time. We've got now new visual effects studios, digital effects. We've got a lot of VR happening. So it's just growing and growing as far as the creative hub. I think Adweek just named us this summer the next tech and creative hub in the country. So it's all happening.
Well, fantastic. Again, my name is John Wildman. We've been talking with Virginia Pierce from the Utah Film Commission, with Irene Cho, and we've also had Lanzia Wan step in and ask a couple questions too. Virginia, thank you for talking to us.
Thank you. It was great to be here.
We are back on The Daily Buzz. Again, my name is John Wildman of Festworks.com, and joined on this segment is Kim Voyner from Wonder Tech Labs. We will be teaming up to talk about Nobody Speak, which plays in the documentary competition section, the U.S. documentary competition section at Sundance. We have the filmmaker here, Brian Knappelberger. And Brian, thank you for being on the show. Before we dig into this this film, because there's a lot to dig in with this film, why don't you introduce our audience to what, because they have not seen the film yet, to what the film is about.
Okay. Well, it's, I'll tell you what it started being about. It started being about the very contentious courtroom battle that was simmering in a small town of Florida between Hulk Hogan and Gawker Media. Hulk Hogan, his real name is Terry Bollea, sued Gawker Media for posting a sex tape of him, approximately 8 seconds of him having sex. And so the trial was about that, and so I was really compelled by this. It was so interesting and bizarre, and it was partly salacious and kind of prurient and an interesting story. But I thought there were some big issues at stake. It was the kind of, you know, big ideas of First Amendment, free press, and also how that relates to privacy. I started following that story, but the story became very much different than that.
Well, I I'm glad you brought that up in introducing the film, because of course we know you from the Aaron Schwartz documentary, and I often am curious on how documentary filmmakers make the decision of what topic they're going to go after next.
Yeah.
Because it seems like there's usually a clear dividing line where there's a personal stake in a subject or a topic. Or it seems like there's someone like you that is literally reading the tea leaves or the newspaper and going, you know something? I want to dig into that. Am I reading this correctly?
Yeah, sort of. There is an element of just something that just pisses you off, too. you know, so that a kind of anger or that sparks a kind of deep curiosity that you want to understand what's going on.
You're like, and I'm so angry, I'm going to spend 3 years of my life and all my money on this.
Yeah, well, yeah, sort of. I mean, it's you do jump in without knowing where it's going to go, and you don't generally have a safety net, as at least at first. But, you know, it's that drive to figure out what's happening. And this trial definitely seemed to have big issues underfoot. This was some big things were playing out even before the enormous verdict. You know, one of the things that was so striking about this trial, and one of the things that made me want to make this film in the beginning, was the $140 million verdict, which was really just a kind of axe that came down on Gawker's head, forced them into bankruptcy. And then the even more bizarre reveal that funding Hogan's case was Silicon Valley venture capitalist Peter Thiel. And so I was actually considering making a film about Peter Thiel before this Gawker case. So I was in parallel compelled by this Gawker case.
So when you found that out, you were like,
so suddenly, how did Peter Thiel enter this story? And so that's really when it happened, and I had to hang on. And of course, that was before Peter Thiel spoke at the RNC became a donor to the Trump campaign, and then, of course, was part of the Trump transition team. So at that point, it was a matter of just really hanging on to this story and understanding where it was going to go and what it meant.
Well, and talking about hanging on to the story and kind of trying to hold on to the tail of that tiger, during the filming process, there is discovery that sometimes happens with a topic like this, and then oftentimes you are in the editing bay and literally finding your movie there.
Yeah,
it sounds like this happened for you actually during the filming.
Yeah, it's always, I think, for me at least, a little bit of both. I like to understand the stories that we're filming before I go out. I do a lot of research. I really try to understand what's happening, prepare for interviews and things like that. But I also like to allow for a little bit of chaos and a little bit of things to sort of develop. And this story definitely developed as we were filming it. One thing that was striking, it had never happened to me as a filmmaker before, is that I watched the film. Trump was in our film through the beginning. I mean, a film about highly litigious, thin-skinned billionaires who can't stand a word of criticism in this
That's
election
like a whole
year.
Subgenre now.
Yeah, in this election year, he's gonna be in the film, but. And I, by the way, took Trump really seriously. I thought he might. I didn't want him to win, but I thought he might win. And so the day after the election was one of the weirdest sort of screenings of my own work that I've ever had. I literally sat down morning after the election. Everybody seemed to be in shock everywhere around us, walking to the office and all of that. And I watched the film. It just was a radically different film than I thought I was making one day before. Even though I took Trump seriously, I mean, it seemed cautionary or something before that. Mm-hmm. I thought it might happen, but this was different. It had happened. It was real. And so a lot of our film was rethought and reworked even after the election.
Brian, I was curious about, as you watched this story unfold and followed it unfolding through the filmmaking process, did you personally remain objective to the story, or did you start to develop a liking for one side over the other and have to kind of maintain objectivity in spite of that?
Well, just to answer that, going back to the trial itself, it was interesting. It was kind of alternately, you know, salacious and highly principled, and you never quite knew when it would be either. And I think as each person took the stand, the side you were on seemed to shift. I think that tension was really interesting. And I also think that the trial was one thing, and the verdict and the revelation that there was a billionaire essentially funding this trial, in secret, by the way, that's a key element, is a very different thing. So I think in my film, if you watch it, you find a kind, I hope, and most people who have seen it so far, have a sympathy for Hogan's case, have a sympathy for the kinds of things that he was arguing. Certainly not a perfect individual, and the case brought up lots of things that are not complimentary, but I think as an individual he comes across pretty well and pretty sympathetic.
Yeah.
So you can have sympathy for that side and still understand that maybe this, even if it was a kind of transgression on the part of Gawker, shouldn't have been the death sentence, and $140 million is excessive, and that this force behind there might be something deeper here, when big money can really put their thumbs on the scale of justice. So,
you're basically saying that Hulk Hogan was used as a bullet to take down Nick Denton and Gawker.
Yeah, I mean this is a stunning. Really, it's a 9-year grudge. It's remarkable. Peter Thiel.
It was a big media conglomerate taken down by a billionaire.
Yeah.
With a shotgun bullet. Right?
Exactly. A successful media organization that was self-funded. It didn't get venture capital funding itself. I mean, it's a rare success story in the online news business. So, but yeah, and it was a kind of it was a tool. It was one of many attempts of Peter Thiel to take down Gawker, and that started 9 years before this, which as a storyteller, as a kind of single element, is fascinating. That's a long time to hate somebody.
I mean, like, even if you were in a personal relationship, that would be a long time.
I mean, yeah, Yeah, who hates somebody for 9 years and takes intricate chess moves to plot their demise? I mean, if you know someone like that, it's probably an interesting story.
And you should follow it and make a documentary.
Well, now I'm also curious that, you know, because, you know, I remember we with the, you know, the again, the Aaron Swartz movie, when you're on your film festival tour and, you know, and talking about that film. And now with this, you know, I'm also curious to hear from your perspective how, when you do a subject like this, you know, how you kind of become the de facto source of information and, you know, and kind of opinion maker of the subject. And it's like something you almost kind of just automatically have to accept. Mm-hmm. But how do you wear that suit? How does that fit with you?
Well, I try very hard to tell a true story, you know, a series of events that happened. These are a series of events that happened. And I may come to some conclusions myself, and the audience may come to conclusions. And in fact, the audience may walk away and be clear as to what conclusions I've come to. But I also find it really, really, really important to rigorously engage an opposing viewpoint and fully explain and portray those people who might strongly disagree with me. I think that's where documentaries actually get the most interesting. If somebody walks away from the film and says, "Oh, we disagree with your premise," to me that's fine. But if someone walks away and says, "Well, you didn't articulate the opposing viewpoint accurately," that would hurt a little more. You know what I mean? That is something that I don't want to do. So you may not walk away from the film saying, "Oh, I wonder what Brian thinks about this." But I do really hope I've done the respect of understanding fully and completely the full range of takes on this.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, again, the title of the film is Nobody Speak, screening in the U.S. Documentary Competition section here at the Sundance Film Festival. We've been talking with Brian Knappenberger. He is the director of the film. Congratulations, Brian, and thanks for being here.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
We are back on The Daily Buzz. My name is John Wildman. I'm here with our producer and co-host, Irene Cho. And right now we're going to talk about the film Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman. It screens in the documentary premiere section at Sundance. We have with us the co-directors of the film, Susan Fromke, Beth Aala, as well as the producer and author of the book that generated this film, Miriam Horn. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
All right, now we want to dig into this, but before we start, I love to let the directors introduce our audience to the film. And Susan and Beth, you two can fight over who gets to do that.
Go ahead, Susan.
This is a film that really takes a look at conserving the great American working landscapes. These are ranching land in Montana, the great wheat fields in Kansas, and in the Gulf of Mexico, we focus on the red snappers fish. So it's a film that really tells the story of four what we call very unlikely conservationists, people who had worked, whose families have worked these landscapes for the last like maybe five generations. But in this generation, they're finding that these natural resources are becoming depleted, and they figured out ways to help make these landscapes sustainable. That's the quick overview.
Well, you know, I'm always curious. I'm always interested to see what I see as themes in films that come out, you know, at similar times. And you know, and the Wendell Berry documentary is also at Sundance, which also involves farming and how that works in the conservation. But that takes a tact of how the industrialization of farming has kind of taken away a way of life. You guys, this film takes another tact, and I would love to for you to talk about how you approach this, because this is one of those things where, you know, even though we had a book to lead the way, this could have been four documentaries. And can you talk about how you guys struck that balance on the focus for everybody that you spoke to?
Well, you know, we, as you mentioned, we had a wonderful guide with Miriam's book, which launched our research. And the way she framed it, it was through the Mississippi River and or the Mississippi Delta in the river. And, you know, the films that Susan and I make, it's subject driven. So we had the wonderful opportunity that Miriam had introduced us with some of the characters already. And, you know, everybody loves a good subject. And I think people really connect with these characters and their history and their deep history in these landscapes. And so it was really just, getting to know these families and trying to figure out what our audience can connect with. And it really is their family roots and their wonderful passion.
Right. But also when you have a film like this, you know, there's a cause element, there's a message element, but when you're dealing with personalities and trying to present people in a real and humane way, sometimes those can be at odds. You know, getting that message across versus, you know, showing people in the light that we, you know, see them or would like people to see them. And I would love, Susan, can you talk about, you know, not just approaching it from, you know, as you guys are doing interviews and you're filming, but even in the editing process, where oftentimes you're trying to find the film that you have.
Well, that's very true. And as Beth said, and we should hear from Miriam as well,
yes.
But Miriam has written this fantastic book, and she really introduced us to the main characters that then became the main characters in her book that became the main characters in our film. But she had a lot, you know, of opportunity to really develop the stories in ways that you really can't develop stories filmically. You know, writing is a very different medium. So we found in the edit room that we really had to find ways to start to explain what our subjects had accomplished, but at the same time, you know, build them as characters and build their story arcs as characters. So we would want to get the conservation story in very strongly, but we also wanted to get their history in as well. And it's, I think the film is very character driven. And these, you know, I feel like to hear the messages, these very strong messages of conservation coming out of the mouths of these characters is a lot stronger than if we were filming a lot of experts saying this. And so that's kind of what we focused on, is how do we... It was hard in the edit room because it's very complicated stories.
Well, and I do want to hear from Miriam because, you know, because this is your baby, you know, in so many ways. And, you know, and obviously you're leading the way, but then you're also kind of at the end, like, you know, having to go, did we get it? Did we get it?
I mean, I couldn't be happier than I am with the film. And we worked almost on a simultaneous track. These guys started within the first year that they were about 8 months behind me. And
wow.
It ended up being this wonderful synergy because we were sharing material all along. So I would go out in the field and share with them, and then they would go out in the field and share with me, and we went on some trips together. And so and they have captured the depth of these families, the depth of their commitment, the love of their land, their history on the land, the fascination of their work and the innovative quality of their work, their unbelievable candor and humility. And no one could have done more justice to these stories, I don't think.
Miriam, what was your inspiration for the book?
Well, I work for Environmental Defense Fund, and we sort of make a practice of working with people who do, as you said earlier, do kind of cut against the idea, the classic idea of what constitutes environmentalists. So that includes, our farmer is an industrial scale farmer. He farms more than 4,000 acres, and he grows wheat for export, and so he's not in the Wendell Berry mode at all. And it was really important to me to push back against this very pervasive and very destructive myth that has been, it's been created by people with vested interests in things like fossil fuels, and that the only people who care about the environment are New Yorkers like me, who don't, you know, who have soft hands and liberal politics. And I really wanted to reveal this heartland that understands deeply that their family heritage, their livelihoods, their traditions only, and their very survival actually, there's the only way that that's going to happen is if they preserve the natural resources.
Are you a rancher, a farmer, or a fisherman?
I've been a farmer, sort of. I grew up in California, spending a lot of time with a very progressive farm family in the Central Valley, and they were my first teachers, and then I worked for the Forest Service in Colorado with a lot of ranchers, and that also had a lot to do with it. I was not happy on the boat reporting that story. I spent the first spent the first morning throwing up off the back of the boat, but I was very at home on the ranches and the farms.
You sound like an environmental superhero.
Oh, well, thank you.
Can we talk briefly about Tom Brokaw narrating the film? How did he get involved, and what is that relationship?
We knew that we needed, in order to bring a cohesiveness to the film, we needed to link the three stories together. You know, it is kind of we start in Montana and we work our way down to the Gulf. And so we felt that we needed to write some narration in order to do that. And who would be a great trusted voice? And we all thought Tom Brokaw. And of course, we knew that he had a big ranch in Montana, and he cared very deeply about, that story, protecting these lands from any development. And so he just seemed to be a natural. And also, you know, so much of the film is also about seeing the democratic process at work, you know, to see how you can find consensus in your communities and then take that consensus to Washington and work with your representatives to try to make changes that will preserve these, your livelihood and your natural resources. And he very much believed in that too, and so he came on quite willingly.
All right, again, the film is Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman, screening in the documentary premiere section at Sundance. We've been joined by Susan Fromke, Beth Alala, and Miriam Horn. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
We are back on the Daily Buzz. Again, my name is John Wildman. I'm here with Irene Cho and Lancia Wan, and we are going to be talking about the Synthesia suit, Res Infinite. We have Kyoko Higo and Ayahiko Sato here, and I'm going to read this really quick because this is almost worth the price of admission. Experience a multi-century climax with the pounding beats and stringed instruments of acclaimed PlayStation 4 VR game Res Infinite, or feel vibrations of candy-colored psychedelic sound rippling through the endless Crystal Vibes universe. The Synthesia suit combines audiovisual with vibral tactile textures to push the frontiers of technology-mediated sensory experience. You know, I'm ready to just pay money just to read that over and over again. So, Lancia, you've experienced this.
I did. I went and checked it out yesterday, got into the suit. I think it was 26 different sensors throughout the body. They attach these little haptic feedback vibration kits to you on your legs, on your body, on your arms. And then you wear the goggles, and then you get this familiar PlayStation remote, and you kind of play a game. Kyoko, I don't know if maybe you could talk about the game a little bit, because I know you work for Enhanced Games and teamed up with Sato-san here. If you could maybe kind of go through.
Yeah, so Res Infinite is the PlayStation 4 and PlayStation VR video game that's already out. It was actually a PlayStation VR launch title, so it's been out for about 3 months. The creator of Res Infinite, he also worked on the original game, which is just called Res. It came out 15 years ago. In any sense, fast forward, the technology has caught up. We've basically brought that over into VR, but his whole idea of not just the sight and sounds and the controller vibrations, but feeling that sensation throughout your body has kind of been almost like a dream come true. So when the game was in development, he sort of put that idea on the table, and then he had teamed up with Risematics, which Sato-san is from, and then also he teaches at KO Media Design, which is part of the university. It's a graduate program in Tokyo. So the haptic programming was done by the students, and then Risematics was in charge of the overall producing of the team, the costume, and everything that went into it. So it's kind of a three-way collaborative project. But we never thought, it was just a side experimental research project, so we never thought we would be here today at Sundance with the suit and the game.
Well, can we talk about the original inspiration for wanting to create this suit?
Because the Res game is very popular.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, Mizoguchi, the creator of Res, with the original, they actually invented what's called a trance vibrator, but it was almost, it's basically a device that kind of fits in the, it's the size of your head, maybe, you know, fits in the palm of your head. It was a USB extension sort of added accessory for the PS2. And then, but that was kind of all that was available, technology-wise and kind of accessibility-wise and how consumers would react to that kind of stuff. But now, with, you know, not just us with Suits, but there's so much more products and prototypes and inventions going on that Mizoguchi thought, you know, if we're going to do it, it's right now. It's the time. Now that we're dropping you into this virtual reality, 360-degree 3D space, that it's like, of course, it's a no-brainer to have you feel everything throughout your body and not just limited to a controller.
And this might be a question for Sato-san, but why did you pick where you picked for the sensors and the vibrations?
So the answer is quite simple, even though a lot of hours went into it. In the end, it has to feel good. We often talk about this feeling good feeling that we want to provide with the feedback. So it was very deliberately sort of calculated and over and over and over again tested actually on Mizoguchi himself. So he would wear the suit and give feedback to the programmer and say, no, that was too hard, or that was too soft, or that's too mild, or that's too harsh. And then so that's how the placement became where it is right now.
And what about the colors? There's LEDs and flashes of light and that sort of stuff.
So the selection or the sort of color palette that we go for is that where the sound or sound textures, essentially the vibration, where it's stronger and deeper and more grounded, has slightly more darker colors, even though they're bright because they're LED. And then kind of the lighter, more uplifting vibrations have lighter color LEDs. So that's how we try to communicate what kind of tapping or that vibration sensation that you're getting throughout your body.
But as a player, you actually don't see the colors because you have the goggles on. So is it meant more for watchers? Is it kind of just as a sensation of light?
And そうですよね。結局プレイヤーは見てないから。
VRってまあプレイヤーだけが楽しめるっていうことが
Everyone needs to have
it. Exactly. So when you slip on the PSVR or any VR headset, we are essentially putting you into your own zone, right? So yeah, you can't see the colors, but we want your friends or family, or in this case, the audience, to kind of get that similar feeling. And so that's why it's, you know, we go through the trouble of even adding those LEDs. In the space that we have at the Sundance booth, we actually have these two vibrating chairs. And you could, if your friend comes with you and they're next in line, or you know, if they're not up for doing PSVR demos, then they could sit on this chair and the same vibration they can feel as the suit. So that's another sort of attraction that we have here.
I love the idea that that we've now gone in the effort to make technology offer up more avenues of entertainment. We are now actually making the audience part of the entertainment for other audience members. I love that innovation.
We totally agree too. Yeah.
And can you talk what it's like to at a place where you have movie stars and famous directors debuting their projects and having, you know, photos and people making a big deal, debuting a project like this in the world of that?
So this is Sundance to eba, eiga toka terebi toka mo chou ma cinema toka ne, so you roots no aru kata tachi toka ma red carpet toka ironna sonna aru naka de wareware no project o koko ni de shutten dekiru tteiu no wa dou iu ma kimochi touyou ka imi ga arimasu ka?
2つ意味があるかなと思っていて、そのストーリーテリングに長けた方々と、あの、まあ、えっと、
触れ合えるっていうのが刺激になる、うん、でもう一つは、我々がその VR だったりとかそれも振動への体験っていうのを、展示することによってその映像のだったりとか映像体験の可能性っていうのを広げるっていうことが見せられるんじゃないかなと思います、mm-hmm.
So I think、largely there's two things. One is we're just simply very、honored to be in the company of those people. Again, we never thought we'd be invited to come to Sundance with a video game plus an extended sort of suit、that, you know, just started out as a side project.、But in the sense of storytelling and narrative, maybe they saw something in this experiential sort of setting that there's potential that in the future, maybe this will become a way of trying to communicate or tell a story. So we're just simply, you know, honored to have been selected. And then secondly,you know, in our case, it's this full body vibration haptic suit. Maybe there's a way that others can、see that and use that as maybe, you know, inspire them to maybe implement that or can kind of take that idea and even take it further for their way of storytelling and communicating with other people or the audience like we just talked about. So,、it's just really inspiring for us and we get a lot of,、I don't know, like triggers.Of you know thinking about what we can do next, and then maybe there's something that others can see in our suit and see potential、for the future of their projects.
Do you think that the fans of the Infinite Res game will be your target audience for the VR interpretation, or are you looking to attract a newer audience that aren't as familiar with the game?
ゲームのユーザーさんたちだけにその例えばスーツみたいなプロジェクトはアピールするのか、それ以外のやっぱり。超えたところの、うん、アピール度も高いと思いますか、
うん、高いと思います、うん、で例えばその、まあ、家で音楽を聴いてる人に、まあ来てもらって、まあ、もっと興奮してもらったりとかあとは前話しましたあの SNS 上で、まあ、遠く離れた人とかハグできたりみたいな、はい、そういう話が
Yeah, so we're definitely not, you know, we're not restricting ourselves to justour Res fans or、the video game audience, we're looking at maybe potentially having this as something that, you know, if you're a music lover and you have this, you know, suit on, maybe it's not full body, we don't know, but it's a way to enjoy and feel the music even better. Or one idea that we were playing around with is that, you know, you have friends far away, thousands of miles away, but you're wearing the same kind of suit or device, and that if you give a hug, you actually can feel itEven though you're, you know, on the other side of the world. So those are applications that we see potential in, not necessarily that we're inventing or we're working on right now, but it is a, maybe a path that can open up.
I love that, giving a hug to the other side of the world yeah. through VR.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
Is this the premiere of the suit in the game, or have you done it elsewhere? Like,
So the one with the LED around the rings is actually, we're calling it Synesthesia Suit 2.0. So it's kind of an upgraded version. But the very first time we debuted it was at a conference called PlayStation Experience 2015 in December of 2015. And that's when we announced the video game Res Infinite. And the creator, Mizuguchi, he actually had a custom-made silver version suit.That looked like a real space suit, but with LEDs flashing. So he was on stage and unveiled the video game.
And how was the feedback from the 2015 versus the feedback you're getting right here at Sundance 2017?
ありますね、あります。あの、振動の一個一個の食感がかなり進化してます。ここはそのクオリティがだいぶアップして、繰り返し繰り返し、そのプレイクス、あ、ツルしてきた。
So in terms of the suit,And the haptic feedback and the programming that's gone into it, since we've had like about a year to work on it and kind of iterate, it's gotten better for us too. Like it's getting closer and closer and better. So you get the feedback even maybe stronger or more accurate and、very specific. But the feedback in terms of just the overall, you know, the suit being on stage and then now you can try it on, we're just getting people wanting to come to their city.It's like, when are you going to come to New York next? Or when are you going to be in Europe next? Because people just want to try it. But there's only a few of these suits because they're all handmade, tailor-made,、and tailor sort of fitted to, you know,、fit these 26 vibrators and actuators. So,、yeah, we're just getting feedback that when's the next time you're going to go on tour? or when's the next time you're going to be at a local event? So it's just exciting for us.
I'm excited to see 3.0.
Yes.
Or maybe there's a baby version 2.2.
Oh, maybe, yeah.
Yes, yes. Point 2.0.
Point 2.0, right. I stand corrected.
The baby should be smaller than the mother.
Okay, well, again, we've been talking about the Synesthesia suit, Res Infinite. Again, we've been speaking with Gyoko Higo, Aihiko Sato. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to The Daily Buzz. My name is John Wildman. I'm here with our producer, Irene Cho. And right now, we're going to talk about a film that I'm very excited about from the Midnight section. The film is 7852. We have the director, Alexander Philippe, here. Welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, this film is a look at, on the surface of it, description, it's a look at the movie Psycho, and specifically the shower scene in Psycho. And again, on the surface of it, you go, well, that's a short film, yes? but no, it is so not a short film, and it is so much more than a one-line description could ever be on this film. And I have to tell you, Alexander, I was looking forward to it because films like this are... even with that description, are right up my alley, like the Hitchcock Truffaut documentary that was out last year. And so I am shooting fish in a barrel for somebody like me. Yeah. But to your great credit as a filmmaker, you really do explore areas that in a very fun and entertaining way that going in, you have no idea that you're dropping into this world. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about first, talk about your inspiration, why you wanted to do this film, and then talk about your approach to the subject.
Well, I've been obsessed with Hitchcock since pretty much the age of 10. I was organizing events at the time with my parents and their friends, showing Hitchcock movies every weekend on VHS, and I would do a little introduction and we'd do a Q&A afterwards. So it's kind of been in my... in my DNA. And
I want to go to your house.
Yeah, exactly. No, Alexander's Hitchcock Hour.
It's nuts. It's a very geeky house. it was a natural film, really, for me to make. And so when I approached my producers at Exhibit A Pictures, that's what we do. We do pop culture documentaries, long form. They were on board. And I'm very thankful that they were because, as you said, this is really... It is the first feature ever made about a single scene in the history of movies. I'm very proud of that. In terms of my approach, this scene is something that I could be studying for the rest of my life and never get to the bottom of. I'm absolutely convinced of that. Because the more I find about it, the more I see. It's really one of those things that it's like the drain. You can, you go down and down and down. It's like going down the rabbit hole. So I could make a 10-hour film about the scene. It wouldn't be entertaining. It would be very interesting. But so the real challenge was, how do you make it compelling and interesting and for an audience to watch it on the screen, and that's very different from making a very interesting book about the scene, So I'm very thankful that we had a great cast of people, and obviously the style of it, I wanted to create this illusion that they're actually trapped there at the Bates Motel watching Psycho, so we shot everything green screen. We had to build a set for the interior. We shot at the Bates Motel with, rain machines, vintage car, the whole thing. So it is really a journey into the heart of darkness that Psycho is.
Well, it is an amazing array of people that you got to participate.
Yeah.
Everyone from Elijah Wood, Danny Elfman, Eli Roth, Lee Whannell, Walter Murch.
I know. Guillermo del Toro, Jamie Lee Curtis.
An amazing group. Just really quickly, on the approach to those people, were they as psyched and geeked out to talk about this?
Pretty much.
Because I get that feeling watching the film.
Yeah, no, they're very, very passionate about it. And that's what's so amazing to me is this sort of infectious passion that people have, 60 years later for that scene that... I got an email from Jeff Ford, who edited, the Avengers movies, Captain America, Iron Man 3, all these big, And out of the blue, he emailed me and said, look, I think about that scene and talk about that scene every single day. Could you please interview me? That's the kind of passion that I found. And it's super exciting to me.
You know? Well, and one, I'm very glad that you brought up the process of how you framed it and the style of film, because it really does enhance it. This is not just a talking head movie,
right.
not just a cinephiles talking about movies,
right.
In a dry manner. No, we're having fun with it because it is a fun topic. But can you talk about how you literally broke down the scene, not just shot by shot, but broke it down from what led up to that and what was going on in film at that time, the shot itself, the music and Bernard Herrmann, how that influenced,
that's right.
all of those aspects.
Well, I wanted the film to actually structurally mirror Psycho in the sense that, you know, obviously 40-some minutes in, you have the shower scene, right? Then you, even though you don't expect it in Psycho, there is that tension that sort of leads you to
absolutely.
It, right? And so the first 40 minutes of 1752 is about really sort of setting the stage and teasing the audience. It's kind of creating that buildup of expectations about we're going to surely deconstruct that scene, right? For me, I really wanted to establish it as, you know, Hitchcock's greatest, most important sort of cinematic trick ever. Really the one moment I think that his entire career, you know, led to. Obviously, really important to set the historical significance, cultural significance of that scene, you know, how people perceived it at the time. I mean, it changed everything, not just the way, you know, movies are made, but the way we watch movies, you know. And so once all of that has been established, we get into this epic deconstruction, which has, you know, it's a very tentacular deconstruction where we go into the sound design, and there's a crazy melon sequence, which I'm not going to spoil it, but we stabbed a lot of melons. Let's just put it that way.
You got to break a lot of eggs. You got to stab a lot of melons.
That's it. That's basically it. But yeah, no, I mean, just that little 2-minute sequence, I had to go and find 27 varieties of melons in season from around the world. And that, you know, we had hundreds of melons on the set.
I think this is my favorite story today.
So all these little things, all these little nuggets, I really wanted to get to the bottom of it. And I think there's a lot of discoveries to be made, even for people who have really studied Hitchcock and Psycho. There's a lot of discoveries.
So for those who aren't as familiar, why the title? Why 7852? What's
so,
the significance?
Yeah, so there were basically 78 setups for the shower scene, and ultimately there were 52 cuts. So it's a very arcane, you know, look, I'm French, so it's a very French title, right? But I think it's a beautiful sort of poetic title. It's a mysterious title, and we'll see how people like that.
Yeah, and I'm glad also that you brought up the fact that, you know, even for, say, someone like myself, that, you know, I consider myself well steeped in Hitchcock lore and what have you, and there was so much information I had no idea about. Mm-hmm. But I'm very curious for yourself. I mean, you know, you had the Alexander Philippe, Hitchcock hour as you were growing up. What were some of the big surprises? Can you name actually just one or two major surprises that you learned in the making of the film?
Yeah, I mean, you know, like to me, when we started really, I'll just give you one little example, when we started exploring the painting that Norman Bates removes from the wall, the Susanna and the Elders, and started trying to get to the bottom of why that painting, but why this particular version of it by Franz von Mieris, we're talking about Susanna and the Elders, this is where it just gets really, you start really looking at Hitchcock in a very different way. Like nothing was created by
happenstance.
By accident.
Yeah.
You know, to me, one of the huge revelations also was actually interviewing Marley Renfro, who will be at the premiere. She is Janet Leigh's body double. And basically every shot that you see in the scene that where you don't see Janet Leigh's face, that's Marley. And she's almost 18 years old now. She's in Park City. And
she obviously has a lot of fun, talking about it.
Oh, she's just lovely. And she is so stoked for the premiere. It's really wonderful. You know, it's like, I mean, you know, here we are 60 years later and, you know, putting her back into the spotlight. But so there were some revelations around her, which, again, I'm not going to spoil. But, there's some wonderful little stories there.
Well, and, you know, again, because, you know, there's so much information that we get in the film, you know, was there some things that you had to leave out? Or are we going to have some DVD extras eventually?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, either that or a book or a series of books or, you know, another film down the road. I've actually started to interview people beyond the realm of the movie because I'm really interested now in exploring other aspects of the scene, the choreography of the scene, the architecture of the scene. I mean, you can go in so many directions, you know, with it. So I think there will be other projects for sure. I don't know if there will be Exhibit A Pictures projects or there will be something else. There will be books. I have no idea yet, but I really am committed to continuing this journey. Because it's just endless.
Again, this is one of those films that I cannot recommend enough. You know, if you're a cinephile, then obviously, you know, this is right up your alley. If you're not, you'll be endlessly entertained. This is one of the must-sees. Again, the film is 78:52, screens in the midnight section. We've been talking to the director and writer of the film, Alexander Philippe. Alexander, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
And we're wrapping up day 6 on the Daily Buzz at KCPW and KCPW.org. This show is made possible with the support of KCPW and our sponsors, Rice Media and Skull Candy. Additional support is provided by Chef Dance, Cloud Electronics, Anki New York, Angry Porcupine, Pop Art Snacks, Park City Roasters, The Big O Donuts, and The Market in Park City. Our producer is Irene Cho.